Voting by smartphone raises huge security concerns. Still, many American troops abroad will be getting out their phones to vote this year.
The fact is that we have overseas voters that live in places where there is not a working postal service.
Also today, President Trump made this claim during his State of the Union address.
As we speak, a long, tall, and very powerful wall is being built.
But our fact-checking shows a different story at the U.S.-Mexico border. And the Seattle City Council wades into global politics.
Most of the comments I heard today had an undertone of religious intolerance. I think we need to speak up against that.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories, plus the effort to keep the coronavirus from spreading into sub-Saharan Africa. Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Mass quarantine camps. That is the drastic step now being taken by Chinese authorities to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Beijing is ordering the city of Wuhan to round up all infected people and immediately send them to temporary camps. Also today, a Chinese doctor who was among the first to warn of the outbreak, only to be silenced by police, died after being infected by the virus. China remains the center of the story, but the World Health Organization is also concerned about the spread of the virus outside of China. Earlier this week, the WHO made a point of focusing on Africa and prioritized more than a dozen countries there for support and screening. All have direct air links to China. John Nkengasong is director of the Africa CDC, based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. The Africa CDC is completely different from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it is important to stress that, as of today, there are no confirmed cases of coronavirus in Africa. But I asked Nkengasong to describe what facilities Africa has to diagnose the coronavirus.
We have facilities in South Africa, Nigeria, and Ghana, and Cameroon, that have quickly developed the capacity to diagnose the virus. By next Monday, 15 other countries would have joined that group. And then on the 20th of February, we are planning to scale that up with an additional 20 countries.
What is the main concern you have with coronavirus right now for the continent?
The main concern we have is the ability for it to spread the way it's spreading in China, which is when you get up any day, you see that an additional 2,000 to 3,000 people were infected. That would become overwhelming. A vast majority of the countries will not be able to cope with such a rapidly evolving outbreak.
Let's talk about the movement of people between the African continent generally and China. Africa has strong ties with China, including very strong educational ties. There are currently a lot of students from Africa studying in China, some of whom want to be evacuated. There are others stuck in China saying on social media that they are running out of food, but they're being told to wait it out. Is there any talk of providing more support to them?
Absolutely. A statement was issued from the African Union, a strong statement recommending that African students who are stuck in China be brought back to the continent.
Right. It's being discussed, but will those students be evacuated or not?
Absolutely. I think they will be evacuated. Egypt has already done that, and other countries, I'm confident, will follow through, given the strong position that the African Union has taken.
If any of the students have contracted the virus, would they be quarantined on the way back to their respective countries?
Well, I think there will be a standard procedure that if students are coming back, there should be arrangements that will enable each country to screen for those students, monitor them, so that they do not just get released into the general community. I think there will be standard operating procedures that will guide each country to manage their patients as they return to their respective countries.
And going the other way, China is heavily invested in economies in many African countries. An estimated 1 million Chinese nationals on the continent working in business, construction, oil, mining. What is the level of concern there in terms of screening and prevention as they return to the continent?
I think that most airports, as we speak, actually conducting enhanced screening, which means all passengers that come through the airports are screened. But there's extra screening that is done for passengers that come from China or the Chinese there. I mean, for example, I was at the airport in Addis Ababa last week with the Minister of Health, and we spent almost half a day there looking at arrangements that have been put in place. And they clearly have a protocol on how to handle the passengers coming from China and Chinese there. So yes, they are paying extra attention to the screening of passengers coming from China and Chinese as a whole.
What support does the continent need? Do all these airports need in terms of screening?
The airports themselves need to strengthen their screening capabilities with systems that can detect changes in temperature or increased temperature when people come in with a fever. They can pick that up. And then the airports have now developed also areas that they can isolate people, keep them for a while before taking them to areas that they can be quarantined, or call them treatment centers, which I personally have tracked that with the Ethiopian authorities. I'm very impressed with what I saw in terms of the preparedness, the ability to contain people temporarily at the airport before taking them to the treatment centers.
As I said earlier, the Africa CDC is totally separate from the U.S. CDC. But right now, how closely are you coordinating with the U.S. CDC?
We are coordinating very closely. We have a call once a week, and the US CDC is also rapidly producing diagnostics that will make those available to as many African countries as possible. So I'm really hoping that by the end of next week, the diagnostics will no longer be a main challenge or a potential challenge for the continent. So we are coordinating very, very closely with them. We are also coordinating very closely with the China CDC, and we have a call with the China CDC on a weekly basis as well.
Are any African countries prepared to welcome foreign doctors to screen, test, or treat either Africans or Chinese who are infected?
I believe that as we speak, African countries should be able and capable of doing that for now. It depends on the scale of if and when we get hit. I mean, the scale of it would determine if African countries will need foreign doctors to come in and support them. But for now, I don't think that is a requirement.
John Nkengasong, the director of the Africa CDC, thank you very much for your time and for answering our questions.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tomorrow on The World, a close look at the critical role of the U.S. CDC in the global effort to control diseases like the coronavirus. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are on the run in Syria's Idlib province. They're fleeing aerial bombardments. And an intense ground offensive as Russian-backed Syrian soldiers push into the rebel opposition's last stronghold. Some of the fighting is taking place not far from the border with Turkey, where Syrian government troops and Turkish soldiers have clashed in recent days, leaving more than a dozen casualties. Amr Al-Azam is watching the situation closely. He's from Syria and now teaches at Shawnee State University in Ohio.
The regime has shown its determination to retake the province of Idlib completely. And this latest offensive is a good example of not just the regime's determination to do so, but also the ineffectiveness of both the Turks in preventing that, and also the failure of the international community to contain this war and prevent it from spilling across the borders of neighboring countries like Iraq, like Lebanon, Turkey.
Now, Turkey has closed its border to fleeing civilians, but we're seeing videos of the roads in Idlib, and they are just jammed with vehicles, families scrambling to get out. I want us to listen to this. It's an English teacher in Idlib we've spoken with before. Abdulkafi Alamdo is his name. He's had to flee Idlib several times, so we reached out to him again. Here's what he told us.
It's nonstop bombing, really nonstop. I mean, the window is just keep moving. My daughter all the time says that the planes are going to come from the window.
The bombing is so constant, he says, that his young daughter is worried the planes are going to come in through the window. Amr, what options do civilians in Idlib have right now?
I mean, not many. In fact, I literally, just before we came on air, I was on the phone talking to one of our colleagues in Idlib, and he tells me exactly the same thing. He said that the bombardment of the city of Idlib itself, where the front lines of the battle are less than 5 miles away, so it's getting very close, and the bombardment is incessant, wave after wave of helicopters and jet fighters just dropping bombs on the city itself, a city that is very congested with civilians. So basically you have over 2.8 million, nearly 3 million people bottled up in this tiny area that's being squeezed gradually. And the humanitarian conditions in there are absolutely catastrophic.
Here's another witness. This is Ahmed Halak. He lives in a town close to the Turkish border. And here he described the exodus of civilians to the BBC.
The streets are crowded with cars, with families fleeing the death. Every time when I'm coming home, I see cars loaded with people and their belongings, and they are moving to the unknown.
And Amr, this is happening in winter, like the worst time for an exodus, or sleeping in a tent beside the road, right?
Absolutely. And winter in Idlib is actually quite cold and it's very wet. So if the regime continues to expand towards the city of Idlib itself and the lines don't stabilize the defensive lines of the opposition, that's when real panic is. This is why the real panic is setting in right now. Now, the latest news I've heard is that the lines are beginning to stabilize around the towns immediately before Idlib itself, the city itself in Sermin and in Nayrab. If the opposition succeeds with Turkish help, because that's the other thing. The Turks are being involved here quite heavily, and they have been providing fire support and actively providing troops on the ground. If this works and succeeds in holding the advance of the regime, then a new front line will be established. If it doesn't, then there is a serious risk that the city of Idlib will fall to the regime forces with an unimaginable humanitarian catastrophe unfolding.
Well, supporters of the Assad regime in Damascus, not surprisingly, see this very differently. We reached out to Namat al-Hamwi in Damascus and asked her what she thought about the Syrian government's push into Idlib.
The Syrian army is about to liberate an area and bring peace back, to bring law and order and peace back to this area. I think it's about time. I don't think that any country in the world will accept to have an area that is not under its control. They will keep on bringing this kind of news that the Syrian army is deliberately bombing the civilians, which is not the truth. And definitely they will keep their eyes closed when it comes to the attacks carried out by the terrorists.
So she says this is about law and order and national sovereignty. Tens of thousands of rebel fighters are in Idlib. Syria's government says they're jihadists, extremists who must be pushed out. But there are also 3 million civilians in Idlib. Do those civilians support the rebels, even the most extreme factions?
You know, civilians are civilians at the end of the day. They just want to survive. And whilst many of them may not support, you know, the jihadi set of factions, they most certainly do not wish to be under control of the regime. And it's also worthwhile noting here that when the regime reconquers these areas, recaptures these areas, this is not some sort of peaceful takeover. Usually it's very violent. It is preceded by a large amount of destruction. And most often the civilians don't ever get to go back to their homes. The destruction, the devastation, and the depopulation caused by people fleeing means that you just have these ghost towns. So it's a hollowed victory, even if it counts as a victory for the regime.
Amr al-Azam is Syrian and teaches at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Thank you for being with us, Amr.
Thank you, Marco.
What is the best way to end 11 months in space?
Christina Cook, your record holder. She is out. Thumbs up and a huge smile.
American astronaut Christina Cook's first moments back on Earth. She just spent a record 328 days on the International Space Station alongside astronauts from the EU and Russia, making her a new world record holder for the longest ever single space flight by a woman. Cook orbited the Earth 5,248 times. She walked in space 6 times, including the first ever all-female spacewalk, along with fellow American astronaut Jessica Meir. In an interview in November, while she was still in space, and the mic kept floating in the air every time she let go of it, Cook explained one of the most important parts of her journey in an interview with The Kelly Clarkson Show.
We are looking at how microgravity in the long term affects the human body and operations, and that's for future long duration missions into deeper space. So going back to the moon and then on to Mars. So that's a really exciting part of our mission too.
For now, Cook is back on Earth, and like many of us on Earth after any flight, she took to Twitter. "What will I miss?" she posted alongside a photo of the ISS. "The exquisite beauty of both the planet Earth and this marvel, the International Space Station, that its amazing people created." You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If the Iowa caucus this week taught us anything, it's that elections and smartphone apps don't always mix so well. An app that was developed to count caucus goers in Iowa malfunctioned and caused major disruptions. Officials say no hacking was involved, but all of this, some say, proves the U.S. is not ready to bring any part of the election process online. And yet, online voting is happening in the primaries and the general election. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports that despite security concerns, some voters will be casting their ballots through their smartphones and computers.
The voters we're talking about are U.S. citizens living abroad and military members deployed overseas. Under federal law, states have to make special accommodations for them to vote absentee. And in some parts of the country, they'll now be able to vote straight from their personal devices. Mason County in Washington is one of the jurisdictions allowing these voters to cast ballots through a smartphone app.
We just sent out the notice to our voters, to our military and overseas voters, of the availability of this. So you know, we are brand new at it.
Patty McGuire runs elections in Mason County. He says the smartphone option will give military and overseas voters more access to the ballot box.
The fact is that we have overseas voters that live in places where there is not a working postal service. It's just a fact. And so returning ballots by mail isn't an option.
Here's an example McGuire gave me. A few years ago, a group of Marines was based on the Yemen-Saudi border. A helicopter would go out to them once a week with mail and other supplies, but it could only land if the wind conditions were just right.
And they would go 2-month stretches where the helicopter would come, push out supplies, and leave and not land because the wind was blowing. So they were getting mail, but they couldn't send mail. Every one of those guys, their first question was, why can't I vote on my phone?
About 500 overseas and military voters registered in the county will be able to do just that in the upcoming primary. And Mason County isn't alone. In neighboring Pierce County, 19,000 such voters are eligible to cast ballots through their phones or computers. And in Utah County, Utah, they can use their phones for the primaries and the general election. Other states are also experimenting with mobile voting. Experts say there's been a proliferation of it in the last couple years. The company that makes the app Mason and other counties will be using is called Votes. That's V-O-A-T-Z. Their CEO, Nimit Sahani, showed me around their Boston office a few days ago.
This is the Votes office.
It's a small office and a small team, about 22 people.
Engineering folks, designers, sales.
Sahani testing, started Votes in 2015. He says technology can boost voter turnout in the U.S., which by international standards is low. In 2016, only 56% of eligible Americans voted in the presidential election.
My biggest fear is few election cycles from now, less than a third of the country is voting. It's not easy for everybody to vote. And so if technology is available and we can show that it's safe enough, why not make it easier for people to vote?
But is it safe enough? Experts say absolutely not, that online voting makes us vulnerable to the type of election hacking we saw in 2016. In fact, in a bipartisan report about that Russian interference released last year, the Senate Intelligence Committee warned states to, quote, resist pushes for online voting. The National Academy of Sciences has warned against it. Election security researchers have warned against it. Lawmakers have warned against it. In fact, just today, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden sent a letter to officials in his home state of Oregon urging them not to use the Votes app. Alex Halderman is a computer science professor at the University of Michigan. He says if we want to do online voting right, we first have to solve some of the most challenging problems in computer security.
You have to remotely authenticate people to make sure they're who they say they are.
You have to guard the servers being used
from some of the world's most sophisticated adversaries, like hostile foreign nations.
And you have to make sure the devices people are using to cast their ballots are secure and won't open up the rest of the system to hacking.
All of these things are extremely hard challenges that we haven't solved in general, and there's no reason to believe that a small startup like Votes suddenly has the magic solution to all of these issues.
Votes says this argument is outdated, that they're using the latest and most sophisticated technology to secure their app and the ballots that are cast through it. But it's impossible to say whether that's actually true. There's virtually no government oversight or required security vetting for election software vendors like Votes. The company says they've voluntarily worked with several private security firms to do audits of their app and systems, but they haven't made any of their results public. Votes has also rejected many, many calls to share their source code or a technical description of their product with security researchers who want to vet it. The company says they don't want to compromise the proprietary information that makes their product special. But Professor Halderman says this kind of technical vetting is crucial.
This past spring, Switzerland was very close to deploying an online voting system, but they did make it open source and let cryptographers examine it. And what happened was the cryptographers found extremely serious vulnerabilities. And as a result of that, Switzerland ended up not using the system.
There's another company called Democracy Live that developed an app and online portal for overseas voters. Their CEO told me that the proprietary source code model is outdated and that the company is looking into making their vetting process more transparent. As for the people running elections in the counties where this technology will be used, they told me that they're satisfied with the assurances they've gotten from Votes and Democracy Live, and that even if there are risks involved, the apps these companies make are much more secure than the alternatives, fax and email. In some states, those are the other electronic options overseas voters have to send in their ballots. And yes, you did hear it right, voting through email. Patty McGuire, the election chief in Mason County, says having to open up ballots and email attachments introduces a whole lot of security risks.
And it is at least conceivably possible that an email coming back to us could be intercepted and the attachment altered, and we would not have the ability to know that that happened.
The Votes app, he says, is a much more secure option.
This may not be absolutely the perfect solution, but it's progress. And I think we can either bury our heads in the sand and say, too bad those folks shouldn't be able to choose their commander-in-chief, or we're going to do everything we can to let them vote.
But as many people I talked to for this story told me, when it comes to secure voting, there's really nothing that beats good old-fashioned paper ballots. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Lydia is all over the election security story. Read more of her reporting online at theworld.org. Programs like Global Entry can make getting through airports way faster.
An awful lot of people who travel internationally are enrolled in these programs because it does allow for bypassing what can be very long lines at JFK, for example, flying in.
But a new directive from Homeland Security means New Yorkers are now blocked from those Global Entry programs. That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. People in New York State may have to wait a bit longer at the airport. The Department of Homeland Security is blocking New Yorkers from most federal trusted traveler programs. You know those lines you look at enviously with people zipping on through. According to Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf, the freeze is a response to a New York State law that limits cooperation with federal immigration enforcement. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration has basically told federal authorities that they cannot have access to DMV records without a court order. Teresa Brown is the Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington and a former DHS advisor under Presidents Bush and Obama. Let's start, Teresa, with what these Trusted Traveler programs are. Why were they created and who do they benefit?
So the Trusted Traveler programs actually started before 9/11, but really took off after 9/11. And the Customs and Border Protection, the border agency that allows people to enter the United States after coming back from abroad, created these programs to allow people to basically be pre-vetted, to validate their identity, their background, are they a trusted traveler, and expedite their travel into the United States. So there are three major CBP Trusted Traveler programs. There is Global Entry, which applies to anyone flying or driving in from anywhere in the world. There is Nexus, which is a bilateral program with Canada that allows crossings by air or by land or sea between the U.S. and Canada. And Sentry, which is primarily used at the U.S.-Mexico land border. And the process for these, applying for all of these programs is the same. You have to provide information on your identity, on an online enrollment, so that CBP can conduct conduct a thorough background check. And once you have passed all of that and had an interview, you can gain access to these programs.
Right. And once you gain access, you're valid for several years and then you have to renew. So now that these programs are freezed for New Yorkers, who's this going to affect the most?
Well, it will affect anybody who has an existing trusted traveler approval that is coming up for renewal. They would not be allowed to renew it. So when it expires, they would no longer have access to the trusted traveler benefits. Or anybody who is considering trying to access them, apply for these programs, would not be eligible to apply if they had a New York State residence.
So embedded in the story, Teresa, as I suggested earlier, is the data in New York State's DMV database that federal officials would like to see. Many states have laws that allow undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. What is different in the case of New York State?
Well, it seems very much that New York State's law is much more expansive in its restrictions on access to DMV data by DHS agencies than other states have passed. And as I understand it, most of the other states that have allowed undocumented immigrants to access driver's licenses do have some privacy protections embedded, but there are exceptions for legitimate law enforcement purposes, or what they're protecting is immigration status-related data, not basic biographic identity data that may be contained in DMV databases.
Cracking down on immigration was a major theme of Trump's 2016 campaign. He kept his promise. Now with the 2020 vote, it's interesting to note that in his State of the Union, Trump slammed so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. Do you see this move against Global Entry and other trusted traveler programs as political retaliation, or does the DHS have valid arguments here?
I think the answer is honestly both. There are valid law enforcement legitimate reasons why DHS would want to and should probably have access to DMV data in New York State driver's license databases, you know, not just for trusted traveler programs, but there are an awful lot of law enforcement activities that DHS agencies do that have nothing to do at all with immigration enforcement, that involve trafficking and smuggling and counterterrorism and counterproliferation and all kinds of other things that they have access to along the borders. Legitimate travel and trade requires identity verification. So I think that there are legitimate reasons why DHS is concerned about losing access to this database. At the same time, as you mentioned, this is a key political issue for the president. He's going to election year and wants to gin up his base. The framing of this as a feud between New York State and the president over immigration works in his political favor. But ultimately, it's hurting legitimate law enforcement relationships among New York authorities and the federal government.
Teresa Brown, Director of Immigration and Cross-Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The U.S.-Mexico border is nearly 2,000 miles long. When President Trump entered office, about 650 miles of fencing or barriers existed along it. We know the president wants more wall, a pledge he often repeats. But what is the current state of this massive project? The World's Monica Campbell has this reality check.
We try to avoid wind in radio stories. It can ruin an interview. But here, the wind is part of the story. In a video from late last month, you see strong winds bending trees at the California-Mexico border. And then these steel panels as high as telephone poles start falling down. A construction crew scrambles to stabilize things. It's the latest story on how the new border fence isn't always holding up. Other reports show where people have sliced through the new fence. An electric saw and a good blade from the hardware store can get right through it. These images chip away at what President Trump said at the State of the Union address this week.
This will be a tremendous boon to our already very strongly guarded southern border, where, as we speak, a long, tall, and very powerful wall is being built.
Trump also stated his goal for the year.
Early next year, we will have substantially more than 500 miles completed.
The administration is far from that. Just about 1 mile of barrier has been built where there was none before. About 100 miles of new border fence have been built since Trump entered office, but nearly all of it replaces previous fence. But those changes, that old fence being swapped out with the new, are drastic. And in Arizona, some environmentalists are alarmed.
We're watching bulldozers churn up indigenous sacred sites, plow over cactuses. Right now, the biggest single threat to this area is wall construction.
Lakin Jordal works in Tucson with the Center for Biological Diversity. It's one of several groups asking the Supreme Court to reconsider decisions that allow construction in areas they want to protect.
It's this beautiful wilderness landscape full of saguaros and Oregon pipe cactuses.
The old fencing was only about 4 feet high, and it was meant to block cars, not people. The new barriers are soaring steel poles. Jordal says they're blocking animals that crisscross the border, like bobcats, deer, and jaguars.
There's like 3-inch gaps, so anything larger than a kangaroo rat will not be able to get through this structure. It cuts the ecosystem in half.
It's unclear if the environmental groups will be able to block construction, but there are also legal fights with landowners, especially in Texas, over new fencing that would go through their private property. What might slow things down, though, is funding. Who'll pay for it all? And that's where one of the president's key declarations when he announced his candidacy has faded.
I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words.
Yeah. Mexico said it wouldn't pay for it. And the president's message about who'll pay for the wall is different now, like when he spoke last year in Texas.
When I say Mexico's going to pay for the wall, do you think they're going to write a check for $20 billion or $10 billion or $5 billion or 2 cents? No, they're paying for the wall in a great trade deal.
He's referring to the renegotiated NAFTA. How exactly Mexico would pay for the wall through the revised trade deal, that's not exactly clear either. So the administration is still searching for the cash. Total construction may cost at least $20 billion. Congress approved $1.3 billion in wall funding for this year. And last month, a federal judge ruled in favor of the administration, saying it could tap billions from Pentagon funding for the border. But the administration will still come up well short of what's needed. There are also questions about whether the fence makes sense. Trump says new wall is needed to block unauthorized migration and drug smuggling. Studies can't point with certainty that more fencing stops people. Plus, many migrants today are approaching U.S. officials at the border, not trying to avoid them. And in terms of drug smuggling, most drugs come through vehicles. Here's a U.S. border official after a big bust last year in Arizona.
The drugs that you see next to me were attempted to be smuggled into the United States from Mexico, concealed within a tractor trailer transporting produce.
He's speaking in front of a pile of fentanyl and meth. The smuggler wasn't caught trying to get around a fence in some remote area. He was driving a truck through a border crossing. The drugs were detected by an X-ray machine and a trained dog. Many argue that if the president really wanted to stop drug smuggling, that's where he should focus his energy. For the world, Monica Campbell.
What are you willing to give up to help fight global climate change? That's a question people all over the world are wrestling with. The city of Rennes in western France has taken a step that some see as radical. The city council there became the first in France to ban outdoor heaters at cafes and restaurants. That has sparked a debate in other cities about whether they should follow suit. Anita Elash reports from Paris.
This cafe terrace down the street from the Eiffel Tower is a popular spot for locals and tourists, especially on a sunny winter day. Today, it's cloudy and rainy, so there are just two customers out here. They're smoking cigarettes and basking in the warmth of no less than 12 electric heaters. Real estate agent Camille Olivier is one of them.
I smoke a lot and I like to take my coffee and I smoke my cigarette, and I need this because in the winter it's cold, so I need this. I need the heating.
It's the hospitality industry. So if Camille wants the heating, then that's what the cafe will provide. The heaters out here are fired up through the day, every day, all winter long.
Donc voilà, j'augmente un petit peu.
D'accord.
Camille's coffee companion is a little cold, so the cafe manager, Léa Ayot, turns the heat up. Ayo says the heaters are a crucial part of her business, especially over the last decade or so when France banned smoking inside cafes and restaurants. In winter, 40% of the cafe's revenues come from the terrace.
Les gens aiment les terrasses parisiennes tout au long de l'année.
She says Parisians love terraces all year round, so she must have heaters to attract customers, especially for people who want to have a cigarette along with their coffee or glass of wine.
Et qui viennent même quand il fait pas beau. Plus de chauffage en terrasse, je pense que la
Ayo says she's worried people will stay home or at the office if terrace heaters are banned, and that could put her restaurant out of business.
Prendront pas la décision d'aller en terrasse pour un café.
Before the smoking ban, heated terraces were pretty much non-existent in France. Now, 3 out of 4 Parisian restaurants have them. But here's the downside. The heaters produce a lot of greenhouse gases. According to the French environmental lobby group Negawatt, one terrace heated with gas for a single winter emits the same amount as a new compact car driving around the world 3 times. Terry Solomon is the environmental engineer who crunched the numbers.
C'est la convivialité, c'est on boit un verre dehors.
He says cafe terraces are an important part of the French way of life, and he doesn't want to lose them.
Très utilisateur de terrasse quand je vais sur Paris, bien sûr. Les gens aiment.
But he says heating the outdoors in the middle of winter is a luxury that society can no longer afford.
Se dire quand même. Une terrasse chauffée.
In Solomon's view, heated winter terraces are a bit like having a taste for strawberries all year round. You have to admit, he says, it just doesn't make sense. Others see that argument as more of a red herring. A millennial after-work crowd of IT developers and marketing folks is crowded onto this heated terrace in the city's financial district. The beer and the jokes are flowing freely.
But we feel good right now with a bit of heating, yeah? Otherwise, probably we won't sit outside.
Really?
So it's global warming, one heater at a time.
Yeah.
One terrace at a time, basically.
These guys, who give their names as Guillaume and Tom, agree that heating the outdoors is both inefficient and a waste of energy. But Tom says it's not his biggest concern when it comes to global climate change.
It's more a lightning rod than a real problem. Like, the world is not going to be better because of those things. Yeah.
What would you tackle first?
I don't know, cost of transportation. I mean, basically transporting foods from and produce from the other side of the world to, you know, by boat and or plane. And there's probably other things we can do that waste a lot of energy.
For now, the mayor of Paris has promised not to go after terrace heaters, at least until after municipal elections this spring. And that's, of course, only if she gets reelected. For the World, Anita Ilash, Paris.
Our newsroom is always looking at stories to understand their global impact. We also look for one other angle, numbers.
3,000 years, 13 cows, 97,000 gallons of wine, $4,500.
That's the world's Bianca Hillier. Every day, Bianca reports the number in the news just for smart speakers. It's a short daily news hit, just 2 minutes long, and it's available 7 days a week. Just pull up the Alexa or Google Home app on your smartphone and add the number in the news to your flash briefing. The instructions are also on our website, theworld.org/smartspeaker. Again, that's theworld.org/smartspeaker. For months, demonstrators in India have protested a controversial new citizenship amendment passed by the government in Delhi. It fast-tracks citizenship for people of many religions, but not Muslims. The U.S. government has not been outspoken on this, but as the world's Rupa Shenoy now reports, the Seattle City Council has.
Normally, the Seattle City Council talks about mundane topics like parking or building permits. But this week, one of the subjects they took up was India's new citizenship law. And this was the result.
The room will be cleared or individuals will be asked to leave. Is the security present?
The Indian Act reduces requirements for citizenship for Christians, Buddhists, Jains, Sikhs, Parsis, and Hindus from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Muslims aren't included. Some at the Seattle City Council said this is discrimination, and Seattle needs to send a message.
Community members do feel unsafe. That rhetoric has already impacted us here locally in our region.
Varisha Khan says Islamophobic messages in India affect Muslims in Seattle. She's a council member from nearby Redmond City.
This resolution, in fact, is a statement against what's happening at the national level, at the geopolitical level, and stands in solidarity with the community here.
The resolution was introduced by Seattle City Council member Kashama Suwant. She says the resolution has wide support among Seattle's large Indian American population, among with others in the community. Suwant says it's important to fight extremism everywhere.
Whether it's Europe or America or Brazil or India or the Philippines, this is a global phenomenon.
The Citizenship Act sparked protests in India because of what might follow it. Nakshi Ganguly, South Asian director of Human Rights Watch, says India may soon have a national registry of citizens. That means officials go door to door to take biometric data, ask about family histories, and inspect documents to see who's a citizen, documents that many people don't have.
Muslims will be then left at the risk of statelessness. It will exclude the Rohingya from Myanmar, even though they have been subjected to crimes against humanity by the Myanmar military. It will exclude people like the Shia or the Ahmadiyya or the Hazara from Afghanistan and Pakistan, who are minority sects who face extreme oppression in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Everybody!
Back at the Seattle City Council meeting, many speakers disagreed, including Indian Americans, like a woman who introduced herself as Padma Ayala. She said the Citizenship Act was actually intended to protect persecuted minorities. Ayala said the city council was misinformed and that council member Kashama Suwant was manipulating them.
Your vote for Kshama is a vote for rape for Hindu and Sikh minor girls.
Okay.
Your vote for Kshama is vote for minority oppression. Your vote for Kshama is a vote against truth. And your vote for Kshama is against citizenship to several minorities who escaped persecution. The next
Lavonia Reddy of the National Federation of Indian American Associations said this is not an appropriate topic for the Seattle City Council.
Every day we wonder what Seattle Council is doing, okay? Your resolution won't affect India. It affects us. You are dividing among us.
Each person only had a minute to speak, so one of them, Archana Sunil, explained more fully for me. She's a health insurance consultant who's lived in Seattle for more than a decade.
There's a historical background to this, and, you know, India is just fulfilling an old promise. It's actually giving citizenship. It's not taking citizenship away from anybody.
Sunil says the Citizenship Act is just fulfilling a promise Mahatma Gandhi made to some religious minorities when India was created. She says the U.S. has also, in the past, provided special citizenship access for persecuted minorities, like Jewish people. Sunil says she tried to explain that to the Seattle City Council.
Their minds were just closed. I mean, when your mind is closed, what can you do? I mean, they just wanted to go with the information that was being fed to them from one side.
Everybody.
The audience at the Seattle City Council meeting grew disgruntled when they were told there wasn't enough time for everyone to speak. When it came time to vote, Councilmember Tammy Morales said, as a Mexican woman and a Jew, she had to vote in favor of Seattle's resolution.
India is a secular country, and I have to say that every comment I heard today, most of the comments I heard today, had an undertone of religious intolerance. I think we need to speak up against that.
Councilmember Andrew Lewis said he'd researched news sources he trusts about the Citizenship Act.
I am prepared today to vote in favor of this resolution as it has been amended. Wow, you know, it sounds like I'm probably not going to get elected to the Lok Sabha, but
the Lok Sabha is the Indian parliament. In the end, the Seattle City Council unanimously passed the resolution.
All of those in favor, please vote aye.
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 Critics of the resolution say it will harm Seattle's ties with India, including vital business links. Supporters say this is just the first step of an international movement against extremism in India. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The rapper Lil Wayne just took a DNA test.
I did my 23andMe. It's kind of like Ancestry.com.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did 23andMe too.
My came back like 53% Nigerian.
Oh,
yeah, me and my mom need to have a talk.
Lil Wayne, 53% Nigerian, he announced the results of his DNA test in an interview with Revolt TV. His fans may not be surprised by this revelation. After all, Lil Wayne has name-checked Nigeria in his tunes. Tracks like A Millie.
A millionaire, I'm a young money millionaire. Tougher than Nigerian hair.
Tougher than Nigerian hair. Lil Wayne now says he wants to take his first trip to Nigeria. Some of his fans there were thrilled to hear that. On the Nigerian show TVC Entertainment News, the host debated what tribe he would belong to.
Looking at Lil Wayne, what tribe do you think?
Little Nwachukwu is Igbo. No. Lil Wayne,
I don't think he's any of the main tribes. I don't think he's Yoruba, Igbo, maybe. I don't know if he's from the north.
You know that.
It's very hard to place Igbo from his looks.
And the head of the Nigerians and Diaspora Commission, Abike Dabiri-Eruwa, tweeted, "Our Nigerian brother, many doing their DNA and identifying their roots. We look forward to welcoming him home someday soon." Lil Wayne is not alone. In recent years, a number of African-American celebrities have received the citizenship of African nations or traveled to Africa to trace their roots. Last August, actor Samuel L. Jackson received his passport from Gabon. Jackson learned of his ancestry after taking a DNA test for the PBS documentary series Finding Your Roots. The rapper Ludacris recently became a citizen of Gabon as well. His wife is Gabonese. Ludacris posted a video on social media in January holding up his new passport.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just became an official citizen of Gabon, of Africa. I am a loyal citizen of Zamunda.
It's Gabon.
I mean Gabon. Since the greatest day of my life.
Zamunda, you know, the fictitious nation in Coming to America. Ludacris still has the keys to his Hollywood Hills mansion, though. No word yet if Lil Wayne will pursue a Nigerian passport. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.